Digging into the region around us, and I do mean digging, yields a rich vein of knowledge about how people lived here years ago. Once a month, we spend some quality time with our in-house archaeologists in a segment we call Underground History. Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose are from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. They are our regular guests slash co-hosts. Mark is in the studio with me now. Mark, always good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
And this month, we broaden the focus a bit outside our immediate region to take in the whole West. You don't need us to tell you that the story of the American West differs from the rest of the country. And so we welcome the editors of a book called Historical Archaeology Through a Western Lens. Margaret Purser is at Sonoma State University. She joins us by phone. Margaret, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Co-editor is Mark Warner, joining us by phone from the University of Idaho. And I'm going to have to differentiate between the Marks here, but Mark Warner, welcome to you.
Thank you. Very glad to have it. Glad to be here.
So, Margaret, let's start with a general question first. If this is historical archaeology we're talking about, what other kinds are there?
Well, conventionally in the United States, you get a division or a distinction, let's call it that, between what's called prehistoric archaeology, which is usually referring to the time before the arrival of Europeans, and then historical archaeology, which tends to refer to the time when Europeans begin to colonize. One of the key differences is that there are written records that are available for historical archaeology, and there are not written records conventionally, as we conventionally think of them, for the pre-contact period. So the archaeologies are kind of different in what they do and how they do it.
Okay. So there is a certain paper trail, in a sense. It's almost like a journalistic
exactly.
thing in addition.
Exactly. It makes the kind of research that we do different. But it also means we're studying a different period of time that's a lot closer to the present, frankly.
Okay. Mark Warner, give us a broad view, then, of the book, Historical Archaeology Through a Western Lens, and what you set out to do here.
Well, we set out to do a couple of things. First of all, we really wanted to draw attention to the historical archaeology work that's been done in the West. Typically, there's been more work done in the eastern United States on colonial sites, and we wanted to basically raise awareness about the work that's west of the Mississippi. And the second thing we wanted to do was to sort of explore some of the complexities of understanding the West. I think people think of the West as one big myth, and we were trying to look at some of the nuances of settling the West, life in the West, and relationships in the West.
Now, I notice there are 10 other authors in the book, two of them working together on a chapter, so this involved a certain amount of archaeologist wrangling, I can imagine, Mark.
Oh, God, that's an
Yeah, I think Margie and I will say this took a year off our lives. Any wrangling of archaeologists is a bit of a challenge. But the neat thing is these are folks that have all had long records of working in the West and working in things that many people don't necessarily think about. And we were able to bring it together in one volume to sort of provide sort of a starting point for people who work and think about the West in with archaeology. In basically a single volume.
Mark Tveskov here in the studio. You guys have worked in other parts of the country. You and Chelsea Rose both mm-hmm. have. And Chelsea, by the way, is going to join us at the bottom of the hour when we switch out Mark Warner. So you've worked in other parts of the country. How different is the process of historical archaeology?
Well, for one thing, it's spread out. Just like the West itself, you go hundreds of miles before you find an archaeologist. Back east, there is an archaeologist every three or four miles. So part of it, like when we go to historical archaeology conferences that tend in the past to have been back east, you'll go into sessions where it's one paper after another about plantations and colonial villages in New England or something, and then a few Western archaeologists. And this book and the thrust of historic archaeology now is to assert that, you know, we've been doing some interesting work here now.
And so, Mark, you start chapter one, which is your own chapter in the book, with a reference to a work of fiction, Wallace Stegner's Big Rock Candy Mountain. Why that book, and more broadly, how much does fiction get in the way of what really happened in the American West?
Oh, wow. Well, let me start with the first question. So that I've always been fascinated with that book, in part because I'm a transplant. I grew up in eastern North Carolina and southwestern Virginia, and so I'm an Easterner who came west and had to learn about this place. And it's been a lifelong process now of essentially unpacking all of the myths that I thought I knew about this place, and instead replacing them with a much, much more complicated set of stories. The thing that I loved about Stegner's Big Rock Candy Mountain is that it's doing very much the same thing, and that main character, Bo, is a sort of iconic figure who's frustrated with the way that he sees the West changing in the early 20th century and becoming less like the mythic West that he wanted, that he liked. So I use him as a way to, in that chapter, kind of set up these myths as how we think about the West, and then kind of look underneath that, sort of peel back that Hollywood curtain a little bit, and look at how complicated the stories really are. And that was, I think, that actually filters through many of the chapters in the book. Most of us who work in the West doing archaeology know that we are working in a context that is mythic, not just for the people who live in the West, but people like myself who grew up, you know, on the East Coast looking at Bonanza and thinking it was real. That kind of thing. So I think fiction plays a huge role in how Americans, and in some cases, you know, the whole world, sort of pictures the West.
Yeah, and I had a thought about that. So can you give an example of the myth of the West and how it might have been challenged by the work in this book?
And Mark, you're going to have to jump in and help me here.
Yeah, well, I can jump in on that.
Yeah.
In some regards, I start off, what I wrote about was exactly that issue. My preconceived notions of the West being challenged. I did a project out in rural Idaho about 10 years ago, and one of the things we found were a series of basically glass crystals. And I'm like, what the heck are these things doing out here? And, I mean, you don't think about it. It turns out it was a fancy decorative lamp that you would have in a dining room. And then a former student had a dissertation, and they had a picture of a parlor in Silver City, Idaho, with a piano sitting in the middle of the parlor. And, you know, what I realized was, you know, the myth of the sort of hard scrabble West is really just that. I mean, you may struggle for a couple of years, but people went to great lengths to domesticate the West really quickly. And you look at these parlors and there are these homes, and they're looking like what you would see in the inside of a home in New York City or Cincinnati. And it's and you go outside that home, and it's dirt sidewalks, it's muddy, there's horses in the street, and so on. But inside that home, it's a Victorian household. And that's just not what you think about when you think about the West.
Right. You know, in chapter after chapter of the book, and I have to say, we didn't initially say to these authors, here's what you have to write about, right? We picked out a few very broad general themes, and what came back again and again and again is what Mark's describing here. The idea in particular that the West has more than one story to tell. So Joe Watkins' chapter that very cogently reminds us that Native Americans don't all disappear at contact, and that we should be doing the historical archaeology of indigenous peoples who are still here, and therefore left an archaeological record in the period after contact. And Minette Church's chapter on the Santa Fe Trail, which again takes a look at a very mythic element in the landscape and looks at, in fact, how the story of the trail has been told over time, and how it doesn't, when you tell a myth, you tell a stripped down story that's very simple and very basic, and that doesn't, in particular, doesn't reflect any change over time. And the minute an archaeologist sticks a trowel in the ground, what you're going to find is change over time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what it, one of the major themes that ended up holding all these chapters together was that the story is much more complicated, there's way more than one, and the West is very, very different places at different times and not just in different, you know, different parts of the West.
Let me remind everybody, this is our Underground History segment. We're talking about archaeology in the American West through the context of a book by Margie Purser, who you're listening to from Sonoma State University, and Mark Warner from the University of Idaho. The book they edited is called Historical Archaeology Through a Western Lens. It involves their work and the work of 10 other authors. And our usual folks from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology are here as well, just not at the same time yet. Mark Tveskov is in the studio with me. Chelsea Rose will join us in a minute. You can join the conversation about historical archaeology in the West and what it means that makes it different in the West. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org.
It seems like we've gone in the history of the American West through these cycles of Turner's frontier hypothesis and then Richard White's middle ground idea. And reflecting on what you guys have just been talking about and the book itself, is what's left from the perspective of historical archaeology today is there a difference between back east and the west after you break the myths and outline the complexities of these different stories? Is there a way... Because if anything, those other ideas had these kind of monolithic notions of differences between East and West. So where are we at now with that?
That's the next book.
Tune in next week. No, I think, you know, I think when we, Mark and I struggled writing that introduction because that's exactly what we had to parse out, right? We had to, anytime you put yourself in a position where you're saying, it's really different over here than what you folks are doing over there, That's a little risky because you're going to then have to say, well, how is it different? And part of what we discovered was that in some ways, and this is what Mark, you were saying, other Mark Tessoff was saying earlier, the actual experience of doing archaeology in the West is different. Our sites tend to be spread all over the place in very large scales of distance, and they can also be incredibly ephemeral. You know, a rancher's line camp, you know, up in the brush where you graze the cattle in the summer can look almost prehistoric in the sense of how few artifacts are there and how ephemeral the record is. And then you can be in downtown San Francisco where you've got entire ships buried. So you get these interesting scales of what counts as a site that I think fewer of our Eastern colleagues tend to work with, although that's probably a risky thing to say. And then there's the idea of the West itself as a place that these European descendant people were coming into. One of the things that some of these new Western historians play with is to what extent was the West actually one of the United States' first colonies? Is it really part of the country? When does that happen, right? When does it really make that transition? And that's another thing that sort of messes with the distinction between Eastern histories of Eastern places in the United States and histories of more Western ones, I think.
Mark Warner, you touched on this briefly about the speed with which the West was colonized, and I just wonder how the relatively short time frame of activity makes archaeology either harder or easier.
That was actually one of the things I was just going to talk about, dovetailing on what Margie said, is, yes, the time depth for sort of Euro-American settlement in the West is much shorter than what you have out east. You have people roaming around Virginia in 1600s, and you don't really get volumes of people out here until the 19th century. So in other words, that does compress things. But I think it also raises an interesting point regarding what we were just talking about, is that there's the fabric of the past is woven into places out east, in the sense of communities have a sense of their heritage in places like Charleston, in places like Alexandria, Virginia, in places like New York City, and so on. That fabric hasn't been, I think, woven into communities in the West as deeply as it has out east. And this is one of the things that I think is kind of an unintended consequence of paying attention to life in the West, is you can start raising that awareness of the histories in these communities that people think are relatively recent pop-ups. Subsequent to this book being done, I've been doing a bunch of small projects in Boise, Idaho, and these have been extraordinarily popular in the sense that we'll have 3,000 or 4,000 visitors to sites in very short periods of time. And part of it is just being aware of, wow, we have history here, which I think a lot of Western transplants don't think about.
Well, Mark, you remark on being a Western transplant yourself, and in fact, you can call yourself a Westerner to people from the East, but people in the West still doubt you a bit, evidently. And I wonder if there's been something then of a westward expansion in historical archaeology, if all of you sitting around this table now, metaphorically, really have changed archaeology because of bringing in your influences from the East.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just going through the list of authors, and I'm an East Coast transplant myself, so I wonder how many of those authors are from the East and how many are from the West.
It's an interesting mix. That's a really good question. We have people in that authors list who were born in England. We have people in that authors list who were born in the West. We have folks who it's quite a mix. Now that you bring that up, I hadn't thought of that before, but what do you think, Mark?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things, and this is when we first started putting this book together, wearing my academic hat, there were about 3 or 4 schools that even paid any attention to historical archaeology west of the Mississippi. Now there's 15, 20, 25 programs that are actively teaching historical archaeology in their curriculum. And I think that's a reflection of sort of the growing awareness of historical archaeology and the potential for historical archaeology contributing to communities and community heritage in the West. Okay. And I think in 20 years it's grown dramatically out West.
Yes.
So was it something of a, to use a rather impolite term, a backwater for historical archaeology, Mark Warner?
Let's put it this way. We weren't front and center in the narrative of most historical archaeology works. the point is, this book is sort of the first book that really pulls a lot of this together. There have certainly been case studies in the West, but we think of it as one of the first edited volumes out there where we're trying to pull all of the work that's been done. If you look out east, you can find all kinds of iterations along this line. Archaeology of cities, archaeology of plantation life, archaeology of the poor, and so on. And it's all Eastern-oriented.
Mark Warner, I understand you have to go fairly soon. Can you stick around for about 3 more minutes?
Sure.
We could take you to a break? Okay, let's do
yep.
that then. Now, this is our underground history segment. We have Mark Warner from the University of Idaho, Mark Tveskov, as always, from the Southern Oregon University, and Margaret Purser from Sonoma State University. We're discussing the book that Mark Warner and Margie Purser edited, Historical Archaeology Through Western Lands, a conversation you can join in the exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. And we will continue through the break. We'll get Chelsea Rose in after the break. I guess I never thought of it in terms of if you're talking about historical archaeology, are archaeologists then, Mark Tveskov, really historians with more upper body strength?
Why,
well,
yes,
good.
That's actually true. Yeah, we have to get outside and we have to go out and walk around landscapes. So to some extent that's true, but I think those barriers are breaking down. You know, we spend just as much time looking at historical documents as we do artifacts. And as some of the topics of these papers show, not only is the divide between, say, colonial or the Wild West history and prehistory broken down, but, you know, we're just as apt now to look at 20th century historical episodes as part of the domain of our research. So, yeah.
Well, in fact, some of the discussion in the book is certainly about, in fact, the first whole portion of the book is about economics and economies. And I wonder, Margie Purser, if it's something somewhat easier to cover because, in essentially, some of the activities are still going on. I mean, there's still mining in the West. There's still timber. There's all kinds of extractive industry going on still.
There's that and the resulting patterns of a highly mobile migrant labor force. And this actually gets back to some of what Mark Warner was saying about the way that in many Western communities, people are reticent to give up the mythic West because that's the only historical narrative that they have. It provides this very nice sort of almost theatrical backdrop to a population that has come and gone and come and gone again as the boom-bust cycles of these economies have gone up and down. I think this is one of the reasons that a lot of people like myself are drawn to these late 19th century, early 20th century contexts, because those are economic stories that continue through the West history from, you know, the gold rush in 1849 right on up through, but they're also really relevant to today. Economic instability around economies that are fluctuating up and down is not something that is just occurring in the American West or the United States. It's a fairly interesting global phenomenon.
And xenophobia against immigrants who are basically here as laborers is another recursive theme.
Yep, exactly.
And those are really tied together. I mean, the extractive industries and the railroads, too, for that matter, employed lots of people from off the continent.
Exactly. And again, something that is hardly lacks relevance in today's world. Which is another piece of the story with historical archaeology generally in terms of, I think, trends in the field over the last 20 years, is that we've gone from being what was once referred to as a handmaiden of history, where we were there to provide artifacts to populate museum exhibits and make them look more authentic. We're now a lot more interested in how the past, especially the immediate past, is relevant to the present.
All right. We'll pick up the conversation on underground history in just a few moments. Mark Warner from the University of Idaho is going to drop off now. Mark, thank you for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having us. We always like to talk about our books and any archaeology in the West. So.
Okay, good. We'll come back.
This was great. Thank you.
We'll come back with the other guests in just a minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I'm glad you're listening, and I invite you to check us out online at jeffexchange.org. You can check us out on Facebook for our social media goodies. We're also on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. We're continuing our monthly underground history segment, our visit with the folks from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Mark Tveskov is in the studio with me. Chelsea Rose is about to join us on the phone, and we've been visiting with the editors of a major new book about archaeology in the West. It is called Historical Archaeology Through a Western Lens. Margie Purser is the co-editor with Mark Warner from the University of Idaho, who was with us and just dropped off. But Margie Purser from Sonoma State University is still on the phone with us. And Mark Tveskov, again, as I mentioned here. And it looks like we have Chelsea Rose on the line as well from somewhere. Chelsea, you there?
I am, and I'm so excited to be here. It's one of my favorite things to talk about.
In the sense of just historical archaeology generally, or in the West?
No, archaeology of the West.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the other folks, I actually grew up in the West, in Northern California and Southern Oregon, so a lot of this stuff is really near and dear to my heart, and also unpacking some of these myths, you know, as somebody who grows up in the West, you also kind of have this mythic sense of what the West is, and so as an archaeologist now, digging in from that way has been really interesting as well.
Let me invite listeners to join us. It's 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Charlie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Margie Purser and Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose.
Good morning, folks. Yes, what's intrigued me about living in the West for the last 42 years after coming out here and being in natural resources, being all over the landscapes, in the wilds, been around a little bit of archaeology also. What intrigues me the most is how different the West actually looks now, ecologically, plants, trees, landscapes, from what it did, 100, 150, 200 years ago. For instance, Eastern Oregon, the vast areas that are now covered in juniper. Not so. It was all grasslands. Juniper was restricted because of the fires to the rim rock, the upper rim rock for the most part, or the desert southwest, where, so much of the area is, cacti and every other little thing that'll poke you or kill you. 150 years ago, 200 years ago, were grasslands, were big, open, gramma grass grasslands, the Wallowa Mountains. All that upper montane area, all that pasture area, not to the highest areas, but that was all covered in green fescue, vast fields of green fescue, wonderfully nutritious, beautiful grass, grazed to death, literally. The whole system grazed to death by the sheep, the sheep ranching primarily in that case. They would chase the retreating snow from the winter up the mountains, and causing tremendous havoc and wreck to rutting, erosion, overgrazing, and stuff. And it's so different now, and it looks so different from what it was under there. So just your thoughts on that and the archaeology.
Okay, appreciate that, Charlie. And good detailed thoughts there. Appreciate that, Margie Percy. You want to take that on?
Well, this gets back to the thing we were talking about a little bit earlier about the early economies in the West, and this, one of the things I like to talk about is that a lot of the movement of these big extractive industries into the West, and we talk about mining a lot, but with timber is the same. It's an extractive industry. There are a number of historians of Western ranching who would agree with the caller that ranching, and especially grazing large herds of animals, done at an industrial scale is just as extractive of the local resources as any other kind of extractive industry. One of the things that we find really interesting in the archaeology is that many of the places that we now are doing research on these sites that would have been in the 1870s and 80s, big industrial complexes with steam engines and narrow gauge railroad and, big operations, are now seen as natural wildernesses by the people who use them as public lands. So that there's this interesting tension between trying to interpret this changed landscape that the caller was talking about as the result of human activity, when in a lot of cases the agencies that own the land really are interpreting it to a public as nature, as wilderness. And in fact, it's very hard to tell this story about, it doesn't look the way it used to look, and it looks the way it does today because it used to be an industrial complex. That's another part of the mythic West that there's some resistance to kind of unpacking. I don't know, Chelsea, what do you think?
Yeah, I wanted to just jump in too, because I think that there's also a myth to the idea that when the first Euro-Americans came here, it was pristine, because,
right,
in fact, there was a long tradition of Native Americans managing the landscape for their own reasons.
Exactly.
And so what is the natural moment in time?
Right. I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's one of the things I think that we can all agree. This is one of the things that's pushing this boundary between, quote-unquote, prehistory and historical archaeology all over the place. There's so much more data now on Native American manipulation of the environment that we just didn't used to have. And so that line between who's modifying this landscape, who's creating these landscapes, and for what purposes, we can study questions about that on both sides of the temporal line between Native American settlement and European settlement. No, I love that you brought that up. Yeah.
Mark Tveskov, how difficult is it to record the kinds of things that Charlie asks about? I mean, particularly in archaeology, where you're dealing with things that are durable enough to last a while underground, like stone tools and human-made things like bottles and stuff like that, versus this sounds like more of a thing for a horticulturalist or somebody else to take on.
Well, we work with horticulturalists, and archaeology is an interdisciplinary effort, and we think about cultural landscapes all the time, which makes the caller's question really important, and that discussion, that there isn't a set baseline. And I think an important part of considering the mythology is how we do tend to like look at the landscape we live in and think of it as natural and unchanging. And as an example of that, and to your point, when we did the research at the Battle of Hungry Hill, today that's a timber plantation with tall trees and scrub vegetation. But at the time when the battle was fought, it was an open grass savanna, which was very difficult for us to see past and see it in those terms. But we were able to determine that by talking to foresters and looking very carefully at the documents of the people that were left behind. And, you know, another project we had recently was in Gold Beach on the Oregon coast. And the Highway 101 bridge over the Rogue River is a McCullough Bridge, one of these beautiful mm-hmm. Art Deco structures. And to me, that the changing in those landscapes, as a historian once described it, was, you know, today Gold Beach is a very small town on the Oregon coast, but in the first half of the 20th century, there were these grandiose Victorian communities, like Margie was saying, with like industrial salmon fishing and industrial logging, and that bridge is a testament to this very different vision of the world. And in a way, being there now, it's almost like middle-aged people living in the shadows of the Roman Empire with this grandiose architecture.
I'm glad to hear it's a little difficult for you guys as archaeologists too, because the rest of us think like, wait a minute, there was a grassland here once, you know, and yeah. So it is hard to imagine sometimes what existed there before. So go ahead, Margaret.
That's one of the things that the West, I think, invites us to do. Working out here, I tell my students, because I do a lot of work with cultural landscapes, and I tell them that my artifacts are about 12 miles on a side, right? So when you're talking about bottles or projectile points, that's true. Those are smaller artifacts, but you don't have to work at that scale. And in fact, it's very helpful, and this is one of the things that several of the chapters in the book do, is to work back and forth from the very small scale of a single site or specific artifacts up to these very large-scale phenomenon that are landscapes or entire, you know, regions that are affected by particular economies like mining or logging or ranching. And the other thing I want to just, you know, to give some credit to colleagues that we rope into our projects all the time, there's nothing like a good soils scientist to help you sort out things like patterns of controlled burning back through the past. Because what they do is look at what's in the soil itself, not the artifacts that the soil is found in. So the whole field of sort of paleo-environmental reconstruction that allows us to sort of look back at what the landscapes were like through time, we get a lot of great data from those folks. And that's only getting more and more sophisticated as time goes on.
Let me take another call here on our Underground History segment. That is Margaret Purser from Sonoma State University, the co-editor with Mark Warner of Historical Archaeology Through a Western Lens, and our usual guests from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, Mark Treskov and Chelsea Rose are here as well. Here's John and Vanita. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning, man. This is awesome. I love it. Just love it. Fifth generation Oregonian here, and you mentioned Rogue River. There's a whole bunch of history packed there in about 100 years.
Boy, okay.
They had early part of the 1900s, they dynamited early river rats, dynamited some of the rapids out of there, things that, you know, who's going to remember that after those people pass on? But what I really originally called up about was, a lot of people don't realize what the timber landscape was like here. It really, seriously, in places, it looked like the redwoods. Some of these trees are so enormous, but they were the easiest ones to get to. And I've been told by old-timers that were, when I was a kid, they're all way gone now, that there was places you could walk from the valley here, out of Eugene area, to the coast under a canopy of giant trees and hardly ever see the sun. And alder were considered a weed tree, and now they have the lobby, from what I understand, to protect them because they're so valuable for, you know, industry. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's just what I wanted to share.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. So I want to move on to, because the book is divided in major sections. Part one, archaeologies of, you got economies and economics in part one, archaeologies of race and racism in part two, reassessing the West in part three. And so Margie Purser, especially with racism, did societal changes now lead to different explorations of society back then? And in other words, the things that happen in the current day spark discussions of, well, we should reconsider this about what happened back then.
Oh, absolutely, categorically, yes. And the interesting thing, one of the little threads that seemed to run through many of these papers was that the archaeologists who were working in contexts where they were studying particular communities in the past are often doing that collaboratively with descendants of those people in the present. So you because you're dealing with a shorter time depth, you're not just using written records to help supplement what you see in the archaeological record. You're standing there talking to people who may well remember the events that you're trying to understand. And I think Bonnie Clark's chapter in the book about the Amache internment camp is a really good example of that. She not only works with the people who are descendants and in some cases survivors of the camp, but they are actually some of the people excavating that site with her season after season in Colorado. There's not only a sort of looking at today and the present and issues that are arising for us here and then saying maybe we should study this in the past. Sometimes we are studying those past events with the descendants of the people who lived through those events, like the burning of Chinatowns and things like that.
But, you know, in a case of a Chinatown or an internment camp, you have concentrations of people of certain ethnicities and certainly in Native American villages as well. I mean, there is a reference in here to a lack of African-American tracking of history.
Yep.
In the West. Is that because there weren't such concentrations?
Absolutely not. There are such concentrations. Mm-hmm. We actually sent out quite a few invitations trying to find someone whose work on that, you know, those kinds of contexts and with African-American communities could be included in the book, and it just didn't work out. And so when Mark made that comment about that's in the next book, that's definitely a chapter that needs to be written. One of the things that's interesting in the West is that you actually have quite a few intentional African-American towns like Allensworth here in California, where recently freed and then successive generations of African-Americans set up their own communities and ran them as their own communities well into the 20th century. And that particular site is now being studied archaeologically. So we're looking for that to come.
Margie, before we go, we got just a couple minutes left here. I want to get into what really prompted you and Mark Warner to put the book together in the first place. I understand this started over a cup of coffee in New Orleans in 2001.
It did. That was a hilarious moment. My daughter at the time was not quite 9 years old, and Mark and I got so into this conversation that I suddenly looked around and realized she had disappeared in downtown New Orleans. And I ran out the door and found her sitting on the curb playing her brand new harmonica with her hat on in front of her. She's gone on to greater things than her mother because she clearly had an entrepreneurial spirit. Anyway, what brought us to this was what Mark was talking about earlier, Mark Warner was talking about earlier, with the center of gravity in American historical archaeology and, frankly, in many ways, American history being kind of anchored to that East Coast. And our field grew up starting with excavating places like Colonial Williamsburg and Plymouth Plantation. And so he and I were realizing here we were both now working out in the West and, more importantly, trying to teach in universities in the West, and we didn't have anything for our students to read that was from anywhere local. Chelsea, you're one of those students of mine. I mean, do you remember my frustration with not being able to hand you guys case studies that were very accessible? So we wrote the book. We pulled the book together primarily to be used by people who were trying to work in the West, whether they were teaching or doing this work as part of cultural resources management, but also, as Mark said, to kind of run the flag up the pole and say, hey, we have this line in the book where we say, there are a lot of people doing archaeology in the West. There are not too many of us who have been able to start doing an archaeology of the West. And what still remains to be written is an archaeology from the American West that says, here's what the stories of the West have to contribute to understanding the rest of American history, 19th century history, the history of, you know, the modern world. That's what we're aiming for, and that's what's coming in these next volumes. This is really just the start of the conversation.
Chelsea, let's get that student perspective, though. I mean, did you find a bit of a paucity of information from a Western perspective when you were in school?
Yeah, and I remember that I took a class that introduced me to the literature of the new Western historians, And that blew my mind because that was, they were talking about a lot of the stuff, but from a history standpoint. And so, you know, from the day I first discovered that, you know, that literature set, my, you know, I've been heading in this direction of how do we do that with archaeology? And that's, in fact, what my graduate research was at Sonoma State University and what I've kind of been thinking about ever since. And one of the things, just to follow up on that, too, with some of the stuff we've been talking about is one of my big agendas, I guess, if you will, is that I really want to remind people or inform people that Oregon and a lot of the far west was very diverse historically. If you were to walk down the street in Jacksonville in the 1850s, you would hear a bunch of different languages. You would see people from all over the world. And that's not how these communities look today, just like some of our natural landscape looks different. But that doesn't mean that that wasn't a really important moment in time for the creation of the far west and the culture and the infrastructure and all the things we benefit from today. So it's really important and a pleasure to be able to go back and tell the stories of all the different people that helped build the west and to try to seek out their descendant communities and to work with them and just to kind of highlight those contributions that have been overlooked.
And speaking of diversity, I think that's what this next call is about. From Mark in Mount Shasta, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and our Underground History segment.
Hi. I want to respond to the lack of information about African-American communities.
Mm-hmm.
I did a documentary 5 years ago called From the Quarters to Lincoln Heights,
mm-hmm.
and it mostly focuses on Weed, California, which is right over the hills from Ashland, which still has an intact African-American community from the 1920s, from the logging industry,
mm-hmm.
but towns like Weed, McLeod, Oroville, there's some towns in Southern Oregon that had large African American communities. So if you look for that documentary From the Quarters to Lincoln Heights, you'll get a lot of that information that you seem to be lacking. And currently I'm working on the African-American history of Northern California from the Gold Rush period.
Mm-hmm.
So the information's out there.
Yep, it sure is. It sure is.
But if you want a living African-American community that goes back to the turn of the century, I'd just go over to Weed,
head up
California.
Yep.
Okay, great.
Thanks
for the detail, Mark. Very much appreciate that. Was this something you had known about before, Margie?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you were talking about communities that were essentially separate communities, so Chinatowns and the Weed example. And I want to go back to Chelsea's comment that we also need to be looking at places that were deeply multicultural because, I mean, Chelsea, I'm thinking about your own thesis. Sometimes towns would get labeled as being of a particular ethnic identity, and in reality, what they were safe places where lots of people who were ethnic minorities could live and work and maintain a community. And those are really important studies. I love to hear about this documentary. We knew the work is out there. It's definitely being done. What we couldn't do was find someone who was in a position to be able to put a chapter in this book. But I think it's a book to be written in the West, and it's a very hidden story that I think needs to be told.
Mark Tveskov, I want to ask you about this because given that we understand now the difference between historical and prehistoric archaeology and the idea that there is certainly a paper trail to be found with historical archaeology, particularly in the West, how thoroughly then do you do the paper trail before you ever begin to take a trowel to the ground?
It's an iterative process, and we have a local historian, Ben Truey, who is an archivist, and we look at these documents, and sometimes documents come while we're actually digging, as was the case with the Battle of Hungry Hill that helped sort of break that case wide open. So it's a back-and-forth process, and I'd like to say that we figure everything out in advance and then dig, but that rarely happens.
Yeah. A lot of times you don't even know what records are relevant to you until you start working the site. It
mm-hmm.
really is a sort of... I like that idea. It's a very back-and-forth, iterative process.
Little of this and a little of that.
And the actual, and so oftentimes you're doing the dig and it cuts something loose because somebody will come out and say, like this caller talking about this documentary. It's like, hey, you know, I know about this. And that's a very rewarding part of the process.
Well, we have learned a lot in this hour. And in fact, we did take the whole hour doing it. We had a couple of opportunities to break away and chose not to take them because we were having so much fun. This is our Underground History segment, as always, co-hosted and visited by Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. Always good to see you guys. Chelsea, good to hear you.
Oh, great to be here. Be here via the phone.
And, of course, the book is Historical Archaeology Through a Western Lens, publication date June 1st. Margie Purser at Sonoma State, Mark Warner at the University of Idaho, the co-editors of that. Thank you both for joining us today.
Brilliant. Thanks for the opportunity.